Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Live from Las Vegas, it's time for you to be Talking Movies with America's most award-winning film critic, John Barber.
You're being so gentle. I've heard you give reviews and you're so rough, you're saying.
How would you have evaluated your own work in some of the films that you did prior to the Longest Shot? I
mean, much better than you, my friend.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Hi there, this is John Barber once again saying welcome to Talking Movies, show number 12. And this is episode number 2 of Great Speeches from Great Movies. And I cannot tell you how absolutely thrilled I am to be doing the show, which sort of accidentally, and you know, to me, the best things in life always happen by accident. By accident, this show seems to be all about the theme of individuality, which has totally vanished in America. And the individual I want to say hello to right now is my cohort and director, Doug Newsome. Doug, how are you today?
I'm doing wonderfully well. Thank you, John. How are you?
Well, I'm great, as you can tell, and I hope you're as excited about this show as I am. And you notice that I'm wearing this Stanford shirt rather than a suit. I could not afford to go to Stanford. But when I accidentally got real people on the air, I could afford to send my son. And I must tell you, I am absolutely, totally crazy about my son. I hugged him from the day he was born till I'm going to see him the next week, and I'm going to hug him again. And I'm so proud of him because he's gone on to become an extremely successful writer-producer and has a series in the top 10 right now on Netflix. So as you can see, wow. I am now wearing my son's hand-me-downs. So there you go.
Looks good on you.
Well, thank you. And the thing about wearing this, it makes me feel like almost like a teacher and like a really good teacher, because I had one guy send me an email. He said, John, when I was a teacher for 30 years, I taught my students by showing them clips of speeches from famous movies, and he sent me all the clips. So that's sort of what I'm about to do. But I must say about my audience, all of you are half my age. So if I'm talking to you about something in the 70s or something in the 80s, you might know about it because you've read about it and you might have an opinion about it, but you will have no feeling about it because you did not live it, but I lived it. And the feelings that I have now, the angers and the passions and the heartbreak, are as strong in me now as they were when they happened many, many, many years ago. When I was a kid, I lived in the theater from the ages of 6 to 16 in Toronto, coming from a broken home. And I came to the United States because of Jimmy Stewart and Frank Capra showing me about American individuality. And of course, those John Wayne movies and those Westerns with American toughness and individuality. So at 17, so excited to get here, I decided not to get any papers and illegally ran off to Hollywood and discovered right away it was one of the greatest myths about America. It was absolutely a crock of bullshit. And at 17, I discovered it immediately. You know, Mark Twain once said, I was educated once, but it took years to get over it. I got over it immediately because what I ran into that affected me and scores and scores of other great talents, not that I was a great talent, I was just a kid, was the House Select Committee and America's fanaticism to create a Cold War with the Soviet Union and to look for communists under every bed and at every typewriter in Hollywood. And the House Select Committee followed one of the most disgusting, degenerate human beings to ever serve in office in America for too many years, and that was J. Edgar Hoover. What they did in front of our eyes, which was totally unconstitutional, would destroy the artists who entertained us and moved us in television and in movies. Lives were destroyed. People committed suicide. I mean, it was just horrifying. And 95% of you all applauded that degeneracy and that destruction of the Constitution. And in the mid-70s, it hit me personally after struggling for 30 years to get my citizenship papers. I am a critic at NBC and 10 years at Los Angeles Magazine. And I'm tired of looking at fake television. I'm tired of looking at fake movies. So I create a show called Real People. And for 4 years, I traveled around trying to get it on the air. Every producer I ran into told me I was an idiot, except for David Wolper. He thought it was genius, but I'd never get it on the air. The others said, John, people want to look at stars and people want to look at the rich and famous. I said, no, they want to look in a mirror. They want to look at people like themselves. And I got a great co-host, Richard Pryor. I only got the show on the air accidentally on NBC. Accidentally. Everything in my life happened by accident. Even the concept of this show that we are doing right now. All happened by glorious accident. And once I got it on the air, a year later, it's the number one show. And people are still denigrating me. Because now these people are thinking, God, if reality television succeeds, we don't need actors, we don't need writers, we don't need directors. So they started to bash me. But having the number one show in the world and loving being an American, loving the movies that moved me and the television that moved me, I decided to do something really worthwhile. And that was to tell a story of the greatest individual in America since Thomas Paine. And that was Jim Garrison, the DA of New Orleans, who solved the murder of John Kennedy in 1967. So with 50 million viewers, I try to tell that story. Of course, the story was sabotaged. Jim Garrison was slandered and destroyed. And I was fired immediately. It was really brutal losing that. But get this. Right now, every one of you thinks that Muhammad Ali is by far one of the greatest heroes in American history. But in 1970, you did not. In 1970, you absolutely wanted Muhammad Ali and Hanoi Jane Fonda in prison or in a coffin for opposing Lyndon Johnson and his fake war. Now, listen, I could not, because of the fairness doctrine, I could not talk up against the Vietnam War, which was obviously fake. So I had these people on the air, and history proved them right, and they probably saved hundreds of thousands of lives as it happened. Listen, America is not the least bit interested in individuality. They are only interested in conformity. I mean, George Carlin said it best. They don't want a nation of citizens and individuals who think. They want a nation of consumers who buy. We are not a democracy. We're an oligarchy. We're a corporatocracy. We do not have free speech. It was destroyed, totally destroyed by Bill Clinton when he put all our media into the hands of six major corporations, and no president has the balls to sign an executive order reversing it and giving us what we need is free speech and individuality. The only recent case of individuality I've seen may shock you and even piss you off. Well, screw you. That was Colin Kaepernick. In 2016, seeing the obvious police brutality and murders of innocent blacks during the national anthem, he kneels to protest. And of course, there you go. Draft-dodging Donald Trump jumps up and screams, "You got to fire him." So they fire him. And he says, "Don't hire anybody like that anymore." Kaepernick led the San Francisco Giants to the Super Bowl, making $17 million a year and risked it all. Also, he lost a mega-million-dollar contract with Nike. And one of my dearest friends, and I do love him because we play golf a couple of times a week. I do love him. He's a wonderful, wonderful human being and a pretty good golfer, wins money for me a lot. He was so pissed at Kaepernick. He took off his golf shoes. They were the Kaepernick golf shoes from Nike and threw them in the garbage. I retrieved them from the garbage. I wear them every single day because they're called Kaepernicks. But now as I look around, I see nobody who inspires me at all as an individual artist or anything. So what do I have to do? I have to go back into my memory bin. What was it that moved me, that brought me here? And there it was, 1949, the magnificent movie called The Fountainhead, a black and white film, the last film I saw in Canada that brought me and encouraged me to come to the United States. It's written by Ayn Rand, who also wrote Atlas Shrugged, and thank God she got the opportunity to write her own screenplay and this speech that is going to knock you up. It stars Gary Cooper. Now, I've always been a fan of Gary Cooper. He's got a really likable personality on the air. No actor in the world can say, "Ah, shucks," better than Gary Cooper, except maybe Jimmy Stewart. This is the absolute only movie where he proves he's an actor. He plays Howard Rourke, an architect. And a bunch of wealthy guys get together and they hire this famous architect to build this complex that will house many people and make them lots and lots of money. So Howard Rourke, Gary Cooper designs it. It is magnificent. And they start to build it. But as they start finishing it, all of these wealthy men don't like exactly what they're looking at. So they hire others to alter it. And when the building is finished, Howard Rourke, Gary Cooper, does not recognize it. So what does he do? He dynamites it. He blows it up. And it is totally destroyed. Of course, he's arrested as a menace to society. He violated his contract. He should be locked up for arson. And on his own, not having an attorney, he gets up and stands before a jury, not of his peers, because nobody could be as smart as he was, but he still got up in front of a bunch of Americans and gives this unbelievable speech about individuality. Doug, could you play Cooper's speech as Howard Rourke from The Fountainhead, please?
Thousands of years ago, the first man discovered how to make fire. He was probably burned at the stake he had taught his brothers to light, but he left them a gift they had not conceived, and he lifted darkness off the earth. Throughout the centuries, there were men who took first steps down new roads, armed with nothing but their own vision. The great creators, the thinkers, the artists, the scientists, the inventors, stood alone against the men of their time. Every new thought was opposed. Every new invention was denounced. But the men of unborrowed vision went ahead. They fought, they suffered, and they paid, but they won. No creator was prompted by a desire to please his brothers. His brothers hated the gift he offered. His truth was his only motive. His work was his only goal. His work, not those who used it. His creation, not the benefits others derived from it. The creation which gave form to his truth. He held his truth above all things and against all men. He went ahead, whether others agreed with him or not, with his integrity as his only banner. He served nothing and no one. He lived for himself. And only by living for himself was he able to achieve the things which are the glory of mankind. Such is the nature of achievement. Man cannot survive except through his mind. He comes on earth unarmed. His brain is his only weapon. But the mind is an attribute of the individual. There is no such thing as a collective brain. The man who thinks must think and act on his own. The reasoning mind cannot work under any form of compulsion. It cannot be subordinated to the needs, opinions, or wishes of others. It is not an object of sacrifice. The Creator stands on his own judgment. The parasite follows the opinions of others. The Creator thinks. The parasite copies. The Creator produces. The parasite loots. The Creator's concern is the conquest of nature. The parasite's concern is the conquest of man. The Creator requires independence. He neither serves nor rules. He deals with men by free exchange and voluntary choice. The parasite seeks power. He wants to bind all men together in common action and common slavery. He claims that man is only a tool for the use of others, that he must think as they think, act as they act, and live in selfless, joyless servitude to any need but his own. Look at history. Everything we have, every great achievement, has come from the independent work of some independent mind. Every horror and destruction came from attempts to force men into a herd of brainless, soulless robots without personal rights, without personal ambition, without will, hope, or dignity. It is an ancient conflict. It has another name: the individual against the collective. Our country, the noblest country in the history of men, was based on the principle of individualism, the principle of man's inalienable rights. It was a country where a man was free to seek his own happiness, to gain and produce, not to give up and renounce, to prosper, not to starve, to achieve, not to plunder, to hold as his highest possession a sense of his personal value, and as his highest virtue, his self-respect. Look at the results. That is what the collectivists are now asking you to destroy, as much of the earth has been destroyed. I am an architect. I know what is to come by the principle on which it is built. We are approaching a world in which I cannot permit myself to live. My ideas are my property. They were taken from me by force, by breach of contract. No appeal was left to me. It was believed that my work belonged to others to do with as they pleased. They had a claim upon me without my consent, that it was my duty to serve them without choice or reward. Now you know why I dynamited Cortland. I designed Cortland. I made it possible. I destroyed it. I agreed to design it for the purpose of seeing it built as I wished. That was the price I set for my work. I was not paid. My building was disfigured at the whim of others who took all the benefits of my work and gave me nothing in return. I came here to say that I do not recognize anyone's right to 1 minute of my life, nor to any part of my energy, nor to any achievement of mine, no matter who makes the claim. It had to be said. The world is perishing from an orgy of self-sacrificing. I came here to be heard in the name of every man of independence still left in the world. I wanted to state my terms. I do not care to work or live on any others. My terms are a man's right to exist for his own sake.
Isn't that wonderful? And another reason I absolutely, you'll have to go to see the film to see what the jury says, but another reason I wish to show it, the villain in this, brilliantly played, was one of my dearest friends, one of my wife's dearest friends for over 3 years. And that was Robert Douglas, who plays villains as magnificently as anyone. Your thoughts, Doug, on listening to that for the first time?
Well, first, I got to say, you are a powerful speaker. witty, and extremely smart. So, and I, every working with you, I know that you're a rare individual.
Well, okay. No, thank you, thank you.
Now, as for that clip, brilliant. It, the way he used his words and used the term a parasite, was brilliant. Brilliant. It almost encapsulates what we see today.
That's exactly right. I hate to interrupt you because I have a feeling of what's going to happen is we're going to run out of, because I'm talking so much, but I have to in order to put this into context because it has more value when you know why it was written and why it was there. This next speech that I want to show you was inspired by Joe McBride, who was a guest on one of my shows for an hour. And the first speech at show, he was one of the participants, and he sent me this wonderful clip from the Dean Martin show, on which I was on three or four times, doing a Red Fox Roast, by the way. He sent me a clip of Orson Welles doing Shylock. So I thought, oh my God, even though it's not a movie, it should be on the air. Then all of a sudden, guess what happens? Whoopi Goldberg gets fired for saying the Holocaust was not about race. And so I started researching more. And what I found was a more magnificent movie made in England about 4 years ago of The Merchant of Venice. And it's not Orson Welles who plays Shylock. It is Al Pacino. The movie The Godfather is one of the most perfect movies ever made. But the most interesting character in it is the second son, Al Pacino. I mean, it's obvious that Marlon Brando is the foundation on which the film is built. But if you look at the movie, only one character grows at all, and that is Al Pacino. And Al Pacino's Shylock is beyond brilliant. I got to say something about Whoopi Goldberg and what she said, and she got fired or discharged for that. The Holocaust was not about race. And the biggest mistake that Whoopi made was apologizing to these hypersensitive idiots, these people who are looking for political correctness, be they Jews or Christians or whatever. It was not about race. It was about religion. When the Germans, 35 educated million Germans, built factories and ovens to put 6 million Jews in, they weren't burning a race. They were burning a religion. Judaism is a religion. There are Jews of every shape and size and color. The same with Christianity, every shape and size and color. The same with being a Muslim, every shape and size and color, okay? What Whoopi Goldberg did mistakenly was apologize to make it worse. She should have gone on the air and say, folks, hey, it was not about race. It was about religion. So you dumbed down idiots, smarten the fuck up. And the other thing is that's so disgraceful, her boss, the president of ABC, is a Jew and he should know better. So shame on Whoopi. Now listen, I'm no fan of Whoopi's. I am a fan of facts and I'm a fan of truth. She was a wonderful actress in early movies. I mean, Ghost and a couple of, she's just totally wonderful. But I have no use for her as a host on The View. And you know what? None of her cohorts came to her defense. And I think that Oliver Stone hiring Whoopi Goldberg, who has no history at all about the assassination of either Martin Luther King or John Kennedy and speaking up about it, Oliver Stone absolutely disgraced the memory of JFK and Jim Garrison especially by putting her in a documentary that is totally, totally meaningless because if you watch it, there's absolutely nothing new. So what I'm going to show you is the most brilliant thing ever written by someone about a Jew. And it is not written by a Jew. It's written 420 years ago by William Shakespeare, the Merchant of Venice. Al Pacino plays Shylock. Shylock is a moneylender. And of course, now that word has come down through the centuries. If you want to go to a moneylender, he's called the Shylock. And a guy named Antonio, who is an anti-Semite, needs some money. He needs 3,000 ducats. The only person he can get them from is Shylock. So Shylock signs a contract. And the contract is so stiff because he knows he is hated by the guy he's lending the money to, and he hates him equally. So he knows he's not going to get paid back, and he wants revenge. And that revenge, allowed in the court in those days, was a pound of his flesh. So this scene, he comes to trial, and he demands his pound of flesh. He speaks more eloquently, written by a non-Jew, about what it is to be a Jew. And notice how brilliant Shakespeare is in the speech. When Shylock, Al Pacino, begins to attack those who own the courtroom, he begins to attack the establishment. It is beyond brilliant and is as pertinent as then, more so today, because I'm telling you, the people who make the laws in this country are the ones who get away with breaking the law. Nobody of import in this country involved with major crimes ever goes to prison. It's always the underlings. So here it is. Pardon me for getting carried away. But I am such a major fan of both Pacino's and especially William Shakespeare. So now, please, Doug, would you play the Shylock speech for me?
Shylock. The world thinks, and I think so too, that you but leave this fashion of your malice for the last hour of the act. And then 'tis thought you'll show your mercy and remorse, more strange than is your strange apparent cruelty.
What say you, Jew? We all expect a gentle answer.
I have informed your grace of what I purpose. And by our holy Sabbath have I sworn to have the due and forfeit of my bond. If you deny it, let the danger light upon your charter and your city's freedom. You'll ask me why I rather choose to have a weight of human flesh than to receive 3,000 ducats. I'll not answer that, but say it is my humor. Is it answered? What if my house be troubled by a rat, and I am pleased to give 10,000 ducats to have it killed? What? Are you answered yet? Some men there are love not a gaping pig, some that are mad if they behold a cat, and others, when the bagpipe sings in the nose, cannot contain their urine. For affection, master of passion, sways it to the mood of what it likes or loathes. Now for your answer. As there is no firm reason to be rendered why he cannot abide a gaping pig, why he, a harmless, necessary cat, why he, a woolen bagpipe, but of force must yield to such inevitable shame as to offend himself, being offended, so can I give no reason, nor will I not, more than a lodged hate and a certain loathing I bear Antonio, that I follow thus this losing suit against him. Are you answered? No!
This is no answer.
You unfeeling man, to excuse the current of your cruelty.
I am not bound to please you with my answers.
Do all men kill the things they do not love?
Hates any man the thing he would not kill?
Every offense is not a hate at first.
You would have a serpent sting you twice?
No!
I pray you, think
You question with the Jew. You may as well go stand upon the beach and bid the main flood lower its usual height. You may as well question with the wolf why he has made the ewe bleat for the lamb. You may as well do anything most hard as seek to soften that. And which what's harder, his Jewish heart. Therefore, I do beseech you, make no more offers, use no farther means, but with all just and plain conveniency, let me have judgment and the Jew his will. No!
Here is six.
If every ducat in 6,000 ducats were in six parts, and every part a ducat, I would not draw them. I would have my bond.
How shall you hope for mercy, giving none?
What judgment should I fear, doing no wrong? You have among you many a purchased slave, which, like your asses and your dogs and mules, you use in abject and in slavish parts because you bought them. Shall I say to you, let them be free? Marry them to your heirs. Why sweat they under burdens? Let their beds be made as soft as yours. Their palates seasoned with your food. You will answer, the slaves are ours. So do I answer you. The pound of flesh that I demand of him is dearly bought. 'Tis mine. 'Tis mine! 'Tis mine. And I will have it. If you deny me, fie upon your law! There is no force in the decrees of Venice. I stand for judgment.
That is staggering. And the magnificent thing about that scene, it leads to one of the most interesting scenes in one of the greatest speeches ever given by a woman. Finding great speeches by women is very, very difficult because for 100 years, this has been a male-dominated industry, the motion picture industry. And to show you how brilliant William Shakespeare was, you know, in his day, women were not on stage, but a woman has to come to Shylock's defense. The original, to Antonio's defense, the original attorney is a man. And Shakespeare has a man get sick. And so the man sends a note to the judge saying, I'm sending a bright young man who is really learned to speak on behalf of Antonio. And that bright young man is really a woman in disguise. That woman is Portia. And I think about this speech because it has been referenced to me a couple of times by a magnificent dear friend and lawyer on Facebook who spends a lot of her fortune fighting for the underprivileged. So this is sort of dedicated to her too, and to all women, but the speech is entitled, by those who are familiar with it, as The Quality of Mercy. So Doug, please play Portia's speech.
I stand for judgment. Answer. Shall I have it?
Silence! Upon my power, I may dismiss this court, unless Bellario, a learned doctor that I have sent for to determine this, come here today.
My lord. Here stays without a messenger with letters from the doctor, and you come from Padua.
Coming from Padua? From old Bellario?
From both, my lord. Bellario greets your grace.
Why do you whet your knife so earnestly?
To cut the forfeiture from that bankrupt there.
And no prayers, please!
No. None that you have wit enough to know.
Be you damned! An external dog! For your life, let justice be accused.
Till you can rail the seal from off my bond, you but offend your lungs to speak so. Prepare your wit, good youth, or it will fall to cureless ruin. I stand here for law.
No!
I stand for law!
This letter does commend a young and learned doctor to our court.
Well, where is he?
He attendeth here hard by to know your answer, whether you'll admit him.
Go, give him courteous conduct to this place. Meantime, the court shall hear Bellario's letter. Your grace shall understand that at the receipt of your letter, I am very sick. But in the instant your messenger came, there was with me a young doctor of Rome, whose name is Balthazar. He comes at my asking to take my place. I beseech you, let his lack of years be no impediment, for I never knew so young a body with so old a head. I leave him to your gracious acceptance. You heard Bellario, what he writes?
Oh, and here, I take it, is the doctor come.
You are welcome. Take your place. Are you acquainted with the difference that holds this present question in the court?
I am informed thoroughly of the case. Which is the merchant here, and which the Jew?
Antonio and old Shylock, both stand forth.
Is your name Shylock?
Shylock is my name.
Of a strange nature is the suit you follow. Yet in such rule that the Venetian law cannot deny you as you do proceed. You stand within his power, do you not?
Aye, so he says.
Do you confess the bond?
I do.
Then must the Jew be merciful.
On what compulsion must I? Tell me that.
Well, the quality of mercy is not strained. Droppeth is the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. 'Tis mightiest in the mighty. It becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. His scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty, wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above this sceptred sway. It is enthroned in the heart of kings. It is an attribute to God himself. And earthly power doth then show like his gods when mercy seasons justice. Therefore, Jew, though justice be your plea, consider this, that in the course of justice, none of us should see salvation. We do pray for mercy, and that same prayer doth teach us all to render the deeds of mercy. I have spoke thus much to mitigate the justice of your plea, which if you follow, this strict course of menace must needs give sentence against the merchant there.
My deeds upon my head. I crave the law, the penalty and forfeit of my bond.
Is he not able to discharge the money?
Yes, here.
I tendered for him in court, yea, twice the sum. If that is not enough, I will be bound to pay it 10 times. Oh, on forfeit of my hands, my head, my heart. If this is not enough, it must appear that malice bears down on truth. I beseech you,
rest once the law to your authority to do a great right, do a little wrong, and curb this cruel devil of his will.
It must not be. There is no power in Venice can alter a decree established. We recorded for a precedent, and many an heir of the same example will rush into the state. It cannot be.
Hey, Daniel, come to judgment.
Sherlock thinks he's won. Daniel, come to judgment. You'll have to watch the rest of this magnificently made film, one of the best I have ever seen, made out of Shakespeare's plays, to see how Portia legally wins. So now, from a 400-year-old magnificent writer, probably the greatest writer who ever lived, to one of the greatest writers in American television. And that's Aaron Sorkin. Aaron Sorkin has written some magnificent, magnificent television. But one of the things that he wrote that moved me the most was a series on HBO called Newsroom. Now, having spent over a dozen years in various newsrooms, I couldn't wait to watch it because I wanted to relive all those fabulous moments in these very, very interesting places. And in this series, Jeff Daniels plays a successful anchorman. And Jeff Daniels not only thanks Aaron Sorkin, but he says Sorkin and his writing and this speech that you are about to see absolutely saved his career. It came on about 2 years ago. And as a newsman and as a successful newsman, he and a couple of other people from his newsroom are invited by a journalism professor to a college to address students who are aspiring journalists. And Jeff Daniels, as the anchorman, is the third to speak. And a young girl, a young blonde, stands up and wants to ask him a question. The question she asks is absolutely embarrassing, but it's meant to be in order to stoke Jeff Daniels to give the answer he gives. As Betty Davis said at the opening of this show, fasten your seatbelts is going to be a bumpy ride. Fasten your seatbelts because you're going to hear some truths about America that may make you feel very, very uncomfortable. And others will be so relieved. Thank God, free at last. Somebody is speaking the truth. So, Doug, would you play this terrific speech written by Aaron Sorkin?
Hi, my name is Jenny. I'm a sophomore, and this is for all three of you. Can you say in one sentence or less what... you know what I mean. Can you say why America is the greatest country in the world?
Diversity and opportunity.
Lewis?
Freedom and freedom. So let's keep it that way.
Well,
the New York Jets.
No, I'm going to hold you to an answer on that. What makes America the greatest country in the world?
Well, Lewis and Sharon said it. Diversity and opportunity and freedom and freedom.
I'm not letting you go back to the airport without answering the question.
Well, our Constitution is a masterpiece. James Madison was a genius. The Declaration of Independence is, for me, the single greatest piece of American writing. You don't look satisfied.
One's a set of laws and the other's a declaration of war. I want a human moment from you. What about the people? Why is America
not the greatest country in the world, Professor? That's my answer.
You're saying...
Yes.
Let's talk about...
Fine. Sharon, the NEA is a loser. Yeah, it accounts for a penny out of our paycheck, but he gets to hit you with it anytime he wants. It doesn't cost money. It costs votes. It costs airtime and column inches. You know why people don't like liberals? Because they lose. If liberals are so fucking smart, how come they lose so goddamn always?
Hey.
And with a straight face, you're going to tell students that America is so star-spangled awesome that we're the only ones in the world who have freedom? Canada has freedom. Japan has freedom. The UK, France, Italy, Germany, Spain, Australia, Belgium has freedom. So 207 sovereign states in the world, like 180 of them have freedom.
All right.
And yeah, you, sorority girl, just in case you accidentally wander into a voting booth one day, there's some things you should know. And one of them is... there is absolutely no evidence to support the statement that we're the greatest country in the world. We're 7th in literacy, 27th in math, 22nd in science, 49th in life expectancy, 178th in infant mortality, 3rd in median household income, number 4 in labor force, and number 4 in exports. We lead the world in only 3 categories. Number of incarcerated citizens per capita, number of adults who believe angels are real, and defense spending, where we spend more than the next 26 countries combined, 25 of whom are allies. Now, none of this is the fault of a 20-year-old college student, but you nonetheless are, without a doubt, a member of the worst period, generation, period, ever, period. So when you ask what makes us the greatest country in the world, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Yosemite? Sure used to be. We stood up for what was right. We fought for moral reasons. We passed laws, struck down laws for moral reasons. We waged wars on poverty, not poor people. We sacrificed. We cared about our neighbors. We put our money where our mouths were, and we never beat our chest. We built great big things, made ungodly technological advances, explored the universe, cured diseases, and we cultivated the world's greatest artists and the world's greatest economy. We reached for the stars, acted like men. We aspired to intelligence. We didn't belittle it. It didn't make us feel inferior. We didn't identify ourselves by who we voted for in the last election, and we didn't scare so easy. We were able to be all these things and do all these things because we were informed by great men, men who were revered. First step in solving any problem is recognizing there is one. America is not the greatest country in the world anymore.
One of the lines that moved me the most was when he said, "It used to be." Yeah, that, of course, reminded me of my youth, my hopes, and my dreams, but it also reminded me more of Jim Garrison, because on September 5th, 1981, when I recorded him for 3.5 hours, when it was all over, I said to him, "Mr. Garrison, whatever made you think you could take on the federal government?" And without missing a beat, he said, "John, I guess I thought I was still living in the country that I was born in." I want to go to another short speech about freedom. Doug, I want you, we're going to skip the Chaplin one for now. I want to go to number 6, and don't mention it, because I want to tell this little story by way of introducing it. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. This is a little story. Of course, when I got to Hollywood, I wanted to be an actor. And so I got... a night job sorting oranges at Barley's Orange. So during the day, I got a day job. So during the night, I could go to night school. I went to night school at Hollywood High because Natalie Wood had gone there and a number of famous actors had gone there. And I got into the class of a once famous, very, very famous radio star during the 30s and 40s. Her name was Miss Strickland. And Miss Strickland, who had just the most magnificent speaking voice, that's why she's on radio, had the talent for being able to pick out scenes. She said, "You know, the toughest thing for you when you go to audition is they're going to hand you a piece of paper with a short speech. You've never seen it before, and then you have to give that speech. I am going to show you how you can take that speech, how you can mark that speech, and how you can read it as though it's spontaneous for the first time. And so she did it wonderfully. I was in the class for 5 weeks, and right across from me was this guy that sort of looked like me. He never participated in any of the readings. He never said a thing ever. But all of us would get up. She'd hand us a scene. She'd say, this is how you do it. Some of us did it wonderfully, and some of us did not. But he did nothing. And then one day, while one lady was standing on the stage and trying to do what Ms. Strickland said, this guy stood up. And everybody stopped. And he said in this sort of nasally voice, Ms. Strickland, you know, our wonderful teacher, but this is not for me. And turned around and walked out. And that was the end of it. About 4 or 5 years ago, I go to see this horrible Roger Corman film. And here is this guy in the film. He is just absolutely awful. He overacts beyond belief. He plays a guy who goes to see a dentist, but doesn't want to any kind of anesthetic. He just wants to feel the pain of having his teeth pulled out. It's awful. But he is, the thing that captures you is you see his absolute joy at acting. And the camera loves him. And the guy's name was Jack Nicholson. Now, in 1969, he's a supporting actor in a sort of a renegade independent film called Easy Rider, directed by Peter Fonda, written by Terry Southern and Dennis Hopper. And he is a supporting actor in it. And I was fascinated by the originality of the screenplay and, you know, bike riders and stuff like that. I mean, there was Marlon Brando in The Wild One, a lot of bike movies, and Electric Guide Blue with Bobby Blake. I loved them because they were showed independent. But there is this great scene. It's summertime and it's night, so they have to stop. And what they do is, of course, they sleep outside on the ground and they smoke their joints. Well, there is Jack Nicholson lying next to Dennis Hopper, and he begins to talk about freedom. It is beyond scary. And the scary thing about it is that everything he predicts about those who hate those who are free happens at the end of the scene. Jack Nicholson has turned into probably one of America's greatest, most interesting actors, even above Marlon Brando. Brando is magnificent when he plays heavies, you know, Zapata on the waterfront. But when it comes to light comedy, he's an absolute dud. Not Nicholson. He is glorious in front of the camera. And this is his speech that got him nominated for an Academy Award for just a few minutes of saying this. This is Jack Nicholson on Freedom in Easy Rider. Thank you, Doug.
You know, this used to be a hell of a good country. I can't understand what's going on with it. Man, anybody got chicken, that's what happened. Hey, we can't even get into like a second-rate hotel. I mean, a second-rate motel, you dig? They think we're going to cut their throat or something there. They're scared, man. Oh, they're not scared of you. They're scared of what you represent to them. Amen. All we represent to them, man, is somebody who needs a haircut. Oh, no. What you represent to them is freedom. What the hell's wrong with freedom, man? That's what it's all about. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's what it's all about, all right. But talking about it and being it, that's two different things. I mean, it's real hard to be free when you are bought and sold in the marketplace. Of course, don't ever tell anybody that they're not free, because then they're going to get real busy killing and maiming to prove to you that they are. Oh, yeah, they're going to talk to you and talk to you and talk to you about individual freedom. But they see a free individual, it's going to scare them.
No, well, don't make them running scared. No. It makes them dangerous. Swamp.
You're right, Jim.
Swamp.
Swamp.
You ever talk to bullfrogs in the middle of the night?
Not generally.
You don't. You know what I used to do?
What did you used to do?
Well, I'll tell you one thing I didn't used to do is talk to bullfrogs in the middle of the night, foolish.
Get out of your mind.
That's right.
What are we gonna do with this stuff, man? Huh?
Get it to his folks somehow.
That's right, in the middle of the night, ordinary Americans murder freedom. Next show, we have by far the most successful publicist in America, representing some of the greatest stars to ever work in movies and television. And he is, and he has the greatest stories to tell about them. He is going to be on our next show in 2 weeks to tell you those stories. And I am going to open the show with two fabulous speeches. I have to, because I got scores and scores of letters from people around the world saying, John, you have to end your show with Charlie Chaplin's speech. And I have a lot to say about Charlie Chaplin, the greatest artist to ever be involved with films, totally and absolutely destroyed because of his individual artistry, destroyed by this country, forbidden to show his movies in this country after 1950. So that's what we're going to do. So we will see you in 2 weeks with a magnificent guest to tell great stories and Charlie Chaplin's speech, and more about Charlie Chaplin. Till then, God bless, stay safe. This is John Barber. Bye now.